welcome to the weekly live. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris. And I was trying to send out a tweet about being live, but that's not going to happen.
That's okay. You can tweet live.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Did you see?
I whack my head on the microphone and say that'd be real interesting to like spend the first minute of the cast going, yeah, go look. So anyway, yeah. If you're watching this, thanks. If you're not, no thanks. But yeah, you wouldn't know anyway.
You should be. You should be.
That's watching. A good way to put it.
Yes. So this week, I thought we would talk about Coyote and Crow on Kickstarter. The Rob Kuntz licenses his works for 1st E through 5E for D&D. So
okay,
one of the original DMs of D&D. Warhammer fan creator joins Games Workshop. Hey. And a D&D movie cast update just for you.
Okay.
All right. So
I mentioned we're not a D&D centric.
But there's such funny news so often. Yeah. I mean, I think they're headed to another movie disaster. So let's enjoy the show. Uh-huh. First things first. So Coyote and Crow is a new role playing game that's on Kickstarter now. And it's a bit unique because of the creators, because of the people developing it.
Okay.
So it's an entire native staff of developers.
Okay.
And this is the setting is North America if Europe never discovered it.
Right.
And there was but it's also kind of post-apocalypse.
Okay.
It's not strictly post-apocalypse. It's not dystopian, but there was a catastrophe, some kind of thing that happened that civilization is recovering from. So it's kind of, let's see, the best way to describe it is science fiction and fantasy RPG set in the near future where the Americas were never colonized, right. And this game is created by a whole team of natives. So the setting is an alternate future of the Americas, and instead of advanced civilizations over hundreds of years after a massive climate disaster changed the history of the planet. So you'll play as adventurers starting out in the city of Kachika, and a bustling, diverse metropolis along the Mississippi. It's a world of science and spirituality where the future of technology and legends of the past will collide.
Right. I knew about this, and I knew I was fairly certain it was an all-native team behind it, but hadn't confirmed that, but just kind of assumed it would be based on what people were saying about it and kind of the reaction. And I haven't looked at the Kickstarter page. I'm a bit tapped out when it comes to Kickstarter stuff because I've been kind of funding a lot of things. I do intend to go look at this. I am very curious about the system and didn't know about the kind of the climate disaster. Having some kind of disaster that player characters investigate and learn more about and kind of seems like a common trope. I mean, and that doesn't mean it's bad, right? It's just kind of like there usually has to be some kind of thing for the characters to find out. And a climate disaster, I think, is a decent way to possibly not make it anybody's fault.
That's true. Yeah, and then everyone is under some similar unique situation, so it wasn't something caused by a certain group or anything.
I mean, it might be. Like, you might uncover that.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Well, I'm feeling maybe kind of cheapen that a little bit. But yeah, climate disaster is kind of a nice way to go. Something's broken. Nobody was really at fault, so let's all work together to figure out what it was.
Yeah, so as far as the system, it's a D12 dice pool system. So you're rolling around 5 to 7.
The most unused die ever. Yeah, okay.
It's becoming slowly the most used die for new systems. And they say about the system that they're striving to present a system that allows players to refer to the rule book during play as little as possible, keeping most of all the critical information on your character sheets.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah. And the other concept that's kind of heavy in the design is fighting being only one road of story resolution. So they want to kind of minimize combat and negotiation and kind of investigation, I think, have a lot more to do with it. And they set up the characters. So your character has stats like strength, spirit, and skills. And they also have a path. So there are 15 paths. Okay. And those are basically like your heritage, your origin.
Okay.
And then you also have your archetypes, which are more like your character classes.
Right.
And so the combination of those two things. And then in addition to that, which is a little bit similar to other games, is Gifts and Burdens.
Okay.
They talk about, so yeah, so kind of, yeah, your flaws and your...
yeah, I see it. You're like, I forget what they call it, like your heritage is kind of like who you are, and then that path is kind of what you do, right? You kind of mix and match them, and yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
And no experience points. Okay. So it's based on short-term goals and long-term goals. And there's a mechanic of writing. So they'll want you to kind of write a story about what your character is seeking. And that's how you kind of advance your character. It'll change their gifts, change their burdens.
Oh, that's cool.
Through reworking that. So yeah, a bit interesting. So they emphasize also that it's not set in a dystopia. So okay. There's new technology putting pressure on old traditions. So the clash is not between colonizers and natives. It's right. between advanced technology and kind of like, you know, things changing, but old traditional ways, which I think is much more interesting because that's, I think, something that a lot of Native peoples can understand. You know, if you came from a reservation and things are kind of encroaching on you and you know there's opportunities off the reservation. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think those voices can speak well to a situation like that. So it fits, it's a fantasy setting, of course, but it fits that struggle, that kind of, yeah.
It also kind of sounds like, or not sounds like, it also seems like it's a way to set up conflict where, again, like nothing is inherently wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Like neither technology tradition is set up as like the evil whatever or the thing that's got to be overcome. So it's just like, no, both of these two things are positive, but they're kind of at odds with each other. Can you sort them out? Or do you want to sort them out or stuff like that? So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the only drawback I can see so far is they're only going to ship to North America. They will do fulfillment, I think, through like digital forms of things, but that's not that's unfortunate because we don't get physical books, or if we get physical books, it's print on demand. It's a different quality, yeah. But
you have to send it somewhere else and have
it forwarded. Yeah, you can have it forwarded. So it is possible to get it with forwarding services. The pledges range from about $20 to about $100, and that gives you kind of everything. And then there's deeper supports and kind of local game store levels and things.
I think I remember seeing something about multiple copies, or not multiple, maybe not multiple copies, but ways to kind of purchase it for other people. I might be confusing that with something else.
But. Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't see that in the pledges, but that's possible. And I've seen that in several games.
Community
copies, yeah. So this certain pledge level will get you a copy plus add a community copy to the kind of the pool. Yeah. And so the creator, as a statement in the Kickstarter, that says, we have a diverse team of folks working on this game, most of whom are Native. Additionally, we are striving to bring in other marginalized voices whenever possible. Our team features people from across the LGBTQ spectrum and is including Two-Spirit folks. It is not even a question that this game is political. If you have a problem with a game where no people of European descent are represented, then this game probably is not for you. That said, we have truly built a game to be played by everyone. It might seem like a big leap, and don't worry, we're going to hold your hand through the whole way through so that you'll be happy that you stepped off the edge with this vibrant, fresh world.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so I think that's a good statement, and it's kind of what we've talked about that probably a year back. We were talking about non-Eurocentric fantasy, and something that came up around that time was the not quite producing anything yet, we don't know where the funds are going, Swords Fall. So that,
Okay. Yeah.
Because that was the Afrocentric and Afropunk.
Right. Okay. Yep.
And that didn't end up producing. So I'm hoping that this project is going to be much more supported, much more backed, and actually produce a community.
I think I saw something recently about preview shots of the Swords Fall book in layout.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of agree that like a bunch of stuff has happened around there, and I've kind of soured on that a little bit. Partially because of how long it's taken to come out, which is not a reason to be sour. I mean, like, stuff happens. I talk about Cortex Prime all the time, and that's like a couple years late, but because stuff is still happening. But I mean, you just kind of accept that stuff happens, things are late, whatever. But yeah, I like that for the Coyote and Crow, the designer specifically said, this is a political game, and if you don't like it, don't play.
Right. Yeah, and they're saying that it's open to everyone. I mean, if you have Native origins, you're going to find more of yourself in the game, but it's not impossible to come from outside that community and be able to, you know, enjoy the setting and the character building.
Well, that's the kind of thing, like, yeah, we've talked before about mm-hmm. how it seems like, or one of the things in the past was people saying, if you don't like this game, don't play it. Mm-hmm. Or it's a game of imagination. So just imagine yourself as these other people. And that seemed to happen a lot when the game was Eurocentric.
You're yes.
Like, oh, you can still play. Just right? It's a game of imagination. You can imagine whatever you want. And then, so now it kind of like the, it seems like now that non-Eurocentric people are coming, you know, that's going to come out wrong because people from everywhere have always been making games.
Right.
So maybe now that non-Eurocentric games are getting more attention and more prominent than before, it's the people going, oh, but we're not in this game. And it's like, well, what did you say 20 years ago? Just imagine yourself as this other thing, right? So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
This is the, you don't like your game? Or you don't like our game, go make your own. Oh, we did. Oh, no.
Oh, like we don't want to have to imagine that. Yeah. So I hope there's good support. The one thing I noticed on the page is, I mean, they have a lot of different Native creators working on it. There's a little bit of an inconsistency. I don't think I've seen pages, like layouts of pages, but a little bit of inconsistency in the art style.
Okay.
And maybe it's just because people are coming from different traditions and different techniques. And also, it's an interesting consideration if you're just saying this is Native, North American Native. Right. That's not a monolith. That's not a single culture. So it's going to be very diverse. So I hope that's expressed well in the paths and the archetypes and the settings. But I also hope that there's a kind of cohesive art direction to the actual book itself. You know, that it holds together. Because they've just showed examples of art pieces. And it's very diverse as far as styles and depictions and things.
Do you think, like I agree, like you kind of want a cohesive book.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about something like Cortex Prime, where there's a lot of different art styles and stuff in there, and I think it all still works together.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that having different art styles for different kind of groups of people would actually work? Would help?
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah.
You're supposed to be cohesive, and I imagine you're supposed to be, the character's supposed to be working in a team, but if you're coming from a sort of, you know, diverse ethnic backgrounds, that's one way to differentiate the groups. And I'm not saying this has to be for people who are non-Native, but for people who don't have any experience with that, different art styles for different, you know, kind of, I need to get a lot better vocabulary.
Right.
Different art styles for the different groups might help people who are not familiar with them differentiate things a little bit better.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So you'll understand kind of the tone of the setting, of the focus of those certain tribes and how, you know, because of how things are depicted, that's their focus. And yeah, so I think that would work well. I just hope that it's manageable because it looks a little slapdash right now on the Kickstarter page.
Yeah.
And it just may be because whatever stage of production they're at, you know, that's what they had to show and they got to start promoting.
Plus from what I've been picking up, Kickstarter, like that, making a page like that is not the most intuitive thing in the world. And sometimes the tools fight a little bit, so who knows.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and there's a lot of people that have been doing it for a while. So when you get those real slick pages, So original Dungeons & Dragons. So Robert Kuntz, Robert J. Kuntz, who is about 65 now. So they mentioned his estate. And so I was like, oh, no, did he pass away? But I guess his estate is like kind of managing the licensing part. So it's probably just a company that, where he held his intellectual property, but is releasing materials for both 1E and 5E. So he is a good description. So he left TSR when Gary Gygax was forced out, and but maintained his, so he created his own company to hold and protect the game worlds that he had created during that kind of early formation time of Dungeons and Dragons.
Which are what?
So those would be the Castle El Raja Ki was created during that original. That setting, that Castle El Raja Ki, in the original Greyhawk campaign. And he was one of the first DM, one of the early DMs that played with Gary Gygax and was involved in the fateful demonstration of Dave Arneson's Blackmoor in 1972. So we're talking about kind of early 70s. Right. So everything that he created for those that original campaign he maintained ownership of, and now it's being offered for licensing. And so TLB Games and Legends of Roleplaying have landed the first licenses of those. And so what you have access to in this archive is 1,000 high-resolution scans of the original Greyhawk, Killebrunn, and Blackmoor campaigns on DVD and USB. So just a ton of material to go through and kind of sort to release as official.
General public will have access to this? Or
no, the licensees. The licensees.
So they are now making this available
for someone
to license.
Yes, this is now available. So, but that's like they actually have everything scanned and sourced now. It's not going to be like a moldy pile of papers, and they're going to say, okay, here's some notebooks that you can, you know, give us this license fee, and then here's a couple of pages. So they should produce some very, it'd be some interesting, very early examples of kind of the first thinking of what D&D is, what Greyhawk was, like what you're doing in those adventures.
I wonder if that's mostly rules or setting or a combination of the two.
I think a lot of setting. I think it was pretty rules light. Like when you watch the original, some of the or discussions of the original sessions or how those same players even play now, they don't look up rules. They don't check rules. They don't care.
None existed.
Yeah, because it's more a lot of that just staying in the action, staying in the game and emphasizing, you know, kind of what's going on, which would be interesting then to develop those materials for 5e, because that's, kind of a refined system that's gone through, five generations of rules development. So it'll be, and so I imagine it's mostly setting, and it's mostly getting that original feel of that really playful, things are not really referring to existing cultures or anything. It's just kind of stuff that they're coming up off the top of their heads, and it may have some influence from their historical, wargaming.
Right.
So yeah, so that should be fun to see what that's like.
I was kind of wondering about that, and that's part of the reason why I asked is, okay, what does that contain? Maybe me being a little bit cynical, this could have been kind of, like you said, kind of like a protection of the stuff that and material he created. Or it could have been like, I don't really like the direction this is going. Let's put this in a time capsule so no one gets to touch it. And so, like, didn't pick up either way. But it could be either of those. And I think I'm a bit cynical and went the, I don't want anyone to touch this. But now, hey, I can make some money from it, possibly. And it would be interesting, I think, academically, to see what early editions game looked like and kind of what sessions were like and stuff like that. I don't, again, this will be cynical, why I asked what settings are there. Like, I wonder if that would be interesting now.
Yeah, well, I think it will be for some players, but I think the tastes may have changed. So you definitely want an original Dungeons & Dragons feel. And I think there may be some people that have, been playing 5e that might want to try something that's not one of the classic adventures that everybody kind of knows. There's kind of walkthroughs and stuff, descriptions of them on the internet. So things have been spoiled. Things have kind of been around for a while and they know what's going to happen. This will be stuff that nobody has, seen before. We don't know how developed and refined it is, but it'll be that early experimental part of it. So if you have the right tone and the DM like really handles that material well, I think it might be an interesting experience, an interesting kind of time travel experience, even if you're going to play with something like 5e, because hopefully if you know 5e well enough, it'll be kind of effortless. You won't be rules checking, you'll just be enjoying that setting. So we'll see. I'm interested, and I don't know the timing, because it's funny, like you're saying, like maybe time capsuling it. He was seeing what was happening with TSR and the money. He's like, I got to get this out of here, so no one is just going to steal it, and I'm going to have to fight a company with more money than I do for my property back. So it's interesting that timing, because D&D is now as popular as ever. This would definitely be in his lifetime the best time to be releasing this. And
until they release 6e and everything falls apart.
Right. Until now it's an unbelievable game. So that looks interesting, and I'm eager to see. And I just hope they produce quality materials. I hope
that's the other thing too.
I hope they've got some good
who knows, maybe Watsy will buy it, or maybe Hasbro will buy it and then just sit on it and be like, nope.
Right. Well, did you ever see any of the fan-created Astartes videos, the fan-made videos on YouTube? So amazing CG kind of space marine combat. Right. Really amazing pacing, but kind of like the creator's own take. I think it was a single creator, too, a single CG artist that created that series. It was amazing, and it just kind of sent shockwaves kind of through the internet of the kind of Warhammer fandom. It's like, why isn't GW doing this?
Right.
And I guess now they kind of are. So they've been promoting for a while, and the name wasn't mentioned, and the name of this creator wasn't mentioned early on, but Siama Peterson was the creator of Astartes. So it's a wildly popular, like millions of views. I mean, it's an insanely gorgeous, really, I mean.
All CG?
All CG, and the Space Marines, you know, running the heaviness of them, but also their super speed and things because of their enhanced, you know, physique, biology. It's just amazing. So, and really nice effects and stuff. So yeah, it's just like, it really hits you really hard. So we're going to see what happens.
You really missed a chance to say like hits with the power of an Astartes. Oh, yes. Like that. Yeah.
Yes. But, so they just made this announcement. So we don't really have details. We don't know what this is going to involve, and it may actually ruin everything. But Games Workshop, Games Workshop has announced that they're going to pay this creator to produce a new series through them. Hmm. So the nice thing about that is it may be lore correct. It'll be in universe, because I think the thing that he presented was his kind of original right. take on things. So it was really unique and interesting, and it may have been better. I know he was inspired by 40K, but it may have been better if it was an original IP, because it was gorgeous stuff. But Siama is going to be producing a new series for Games Workshop, and this is following the announcement of some other fan creators that were brought in. Okay. So Richard Boylan produced the Hell's Reach. So he did some animation using kind of tools he had used for doing like video game cutscenes for the Hell's Reach audiobook. So the really wonderful audiobook reading, the you know, voice actor doing that, and just then recreating some of those scenes. And it was very, very cinematic. I don't know if it's going to hold up particularly well. The technique that was used looks, you know, it's not aging well. But it was a great depiction of that audiobook. And he's working on an Angels of Death, so a Blood Angels series. And then there's also Lost Legion Studios is working on the Exodite, which I think is an all CG version. Hmm. So a story about the Tau. And Paxel Art is
funny.
Working.
I guess they called them, because for me, like when I was in Warhammer 40K, Exodite was the Exodite Knights, which was like the slightly primitive kind of backwater Eldar.
Oh, interesting.
So
yeah.
So hearing it called Exodite and then it being about the Tau kind of made me go, huh? What?
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah.
Sorry. Maybe it's not Exodite anymore. It's Eldari and Drukhari.
Oh, right.
And
right
who
right.
knows what
so
else.
Maybe so maybe that name was changed as well. Yeah. So Paxel Art is doing the Primaris, the Last Templar, and Codex Films is doing an Iron Warriors series called Iron Within. They've given us some clips and things, and it's a real, like, it's CG, it's digital cell animation, it's a real range of styles, and it's a little amateur looking to put for Games Workshop to be putting the stamp on some of this stuff. Some of this stuff is like, gah. And so the passion that went into this Astartes project and the polish that a single person put on these videos, I hope can translate. I hope they don't give him a deadline that's impossible to give him like changes and things like, you know, art direction and stuff that could totally ruins, because it looks like that's what happened with some of this other stuff is it just got a little, they got some producers or some people getting in the way, and it's okay. It just looks like a war, you know, like a 40K film festival kind of thing. Not like this is gorgeous, original, the best we can come up with, you know, content for these, for this,
fair universe. Enough. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking of like the one and only Golden Demon convention I went to back in like 96, 95, 96. And I only remember it because I dragged my poor dad down to Baltimore on the train for him to walk around this arena full of nerds that I can only imagine what he went through. So dad, thank you for that. But there was a live action clip of Space Marines fighting, I think it was like Gene Stealers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it was like, they had made, and it was actors in suits, and I'm sure it looks terrible now, but at the time it looked pretty good. Mm-hmm. But I just remember that, and the connection here is, okay, well, Games Workshop has a lot of money, and you would think they would pay for quality. This, I guess, a less cynical, for me, take would be, we like what you did.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some money to keep doing it. right?
Right.
And like, even if we don't particularly like the style or whatever, mm-hmm. maybe these things were popular enough for Games Workshop to take notice, right?
Mm.
And I don't know. I'm trying to put a positive spin on it. And I haven't seen them, and I might come back next week and go, whoa, you were right.
Yeah,
some of these, just the style did not grab me at all. But I kind of think of like the Animatrix, right?
Mm.
Like all those little shorts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how I didn't, or even the horribly misogynistic Love, Death, and Robots, where some of those things that Netflix put out, some of those were excellent. And others were like, oh, what the, let me skip through. Maybe that's the same idea here. Like, not to intentionally produce bad stuff, because who wants to do that? It's just kind of like, we want a selection of different styles and artwork or whatever.
Right,
so
right.
There you go. And like, I do hope what you said is kind of correct. Like, I hope GW, I mean, they have to have some control, right? Because it's their IP.
I
hope they don't micromanage to the point where it becomes this kind of like soulless corporate creation.
Yeah. And fan creation is all passion and all kind of dedication. And then when they give you a budget and a deadline and you're saying, okay, what, I'm going to make, what, $10 an hour if I put the, you know, 200 hours into this thing? You know, we don't know what kind of budgets they're giving. We don't know what their business model is for this. This may be just, and the thing I'm kind of worried about is just audition pieces for like Netflix series or things that they can sell to Amazon and stuff. So we're not going to, I mean, because what is the business model? There is no short animation market. People aren't going to be buying these individual episodes. You know, they would have to sell to a streaming. They'd have to license this as a series to a streaming. And the only thing we've heard about them actually doing that with is the Eisenhorn. So the Big Light Productions. Big Light Productions is still doing pre-production for Amazon's potential Eisenhorn series, but based on the Dan Abnett novels.
Which was actually okay, I think. One of the few that I read. The books that I read. And that's not... generally, I tend to think that fiction that's part of an existing IP just isn't great. But Eisenhorn was good, and the Horace Heresy trilogy was way better than it had to be.
Mm.
Especially for someone as cardboard as boring as Space Marines. But one of the other possibilities is this is viral marketing.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, get some social media.
It could be. Like, not that GW really needs it, because they have rabidly dedicated fans that follow them through every yearly price hike. But, I mean, like, outside of miniature wargaming, they're still kind of nobodies, right?
Yeah.
Not nobodies. I mean, that's a bit extreme. But this is a way for them to go, hey, here's some YouTube content, or here's some stuff, and it probably will get shopped around to make series, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Right.
But it's...
And if it's going to go to series, it has to go to a studio. It can't, single creator can't make a series.
I think...
It's a little bit difficult, because I think, like you're saying, it probably is a PR move, because they're like, millions of people are watching these videos. That would expand our brand, get people towards the models, towards the video games and, you know, other entertainment card games and things they're releasing.
Hey, let's partner with Magic.
So it's awareness of the brand. So that also leads me to believe they're not going to pay these creators enough to actually do this stuff. That, you know, they're going to say, well, you were doing it for free, so why isn't $2,000 enough to produce? You know, like, okay, but if you were approaching a studio to produce this, it would be a totally different budget. So I don't know. I'm a little bit worried. You have to see. Go watch Astartes.
Okay.
It's I'll put a link also to that playlist in the description, because if you haven't seen it, and even if you aren't have a big awareness of Warhammer 40K, it's amazing, kind of crunchy sci-fi, like, you know, really, you know, things not getting together, bullets, you know, bouncing off of armor and stuff. Yeah, it's really, really well done. And there's been some attempts, and I think I've even seen some like old cutscenes from PC games
that have been
costumes and so video, people in costumes trying to recreate some of the things. But CG and the level that CG is at now is a good way, I think, to portray that. And I think there's a Korean creator and then an Eastern European creator that have kind of messed around with started their other own projects. So it's nice that the one thing you have to say, GW may blow this, but at least they're not just sending cease and desist and saying,
RIP,
fuck off.
They're
actually saying, okay, why don't you try to do that for us? Have all our resources, you know, we'll you know, whatever support you want, have, you know, maybe hook you up with a writer or something to actually, you know, give you something, help you develop something. So we'll see. But just the stuff they've shown so far, I'm not impressed. Just like the comics, all 40K comics have been pretty disappointing.
Not a conspiracy theory, but just talking about how Magic is probably going to do Warhammer 40K crossover.
Right.
Maybe this is somehow connected to that. because they're going to bring in, they're at least going to have more eyes on their stuff the Magic players.
Right.
Though I mean, there's got to be a massive overlap between, you know, Magic players and 40K players, just because they're in kind of the same sphere of game.
Yeah,
right?
And going to the same shops.
And I'm not saying it's 100% overlap.
Yeah.
I'm saying there's a fair amount.
Yeah,
but still, I mean, this will bring in new people, and maybe they said, hey, how about some marketing, and it'll look better for us to support the people who are already kind of doing it rather than sending cease and desist like you already said. Yeah.
Or approaching these, like, kind of fly-by-night Korean studios or whatever to produce stuff like a lot of the video games have done. Like when they want to release like this media blitz, like EA and a couple of studios have done that. It's like, releasing this game, now we'll release a straight-to-video, you know, animated story or something. And the animation is just garbage. And it's just, they just kind of like, you know, half-ass it out. So this is going to be, I mean, if there's people with passion involved and they're actually going to get paid and like, wow, I'm working for Games Workshop, if that's enough to like really kind of dazzle them into producing, it might be good. I don't know.
I'm trying to think of some kind of skulls with a skull throne, kind of, because that's my image of, as someone who used to work for GW for a very short time, that's my image of working for GW. Eventually, you just end up as a skull underneath a skull throne.
Yeah, exactly. Your skull will be added. Yeah. Fan films for the fandom throne. Yeah, so we'll see. So good luck to everybody that's working on those projects. I mean, you've done great work so far. The stuff that hasn't been sanctioned by Games Workshop is amazing. So please resist the temptation to let them screw it up. But before we go, I would love to give you an update on the on what is becoming the mess of...
A mess of
Dungeons & Dragons, the movie.
Is that what we call a group of D&D movies? A mess.
Okay. A mess. Yes, that's exactly. Okay. It's not a murder. It's a mess. So Chris Pine, we know, was already on board.
Okay.
And this movie is being produced by Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daley, who directed Game Night and wrote Spider-Man Homecoming. So they've been involved in some films, but that doesn't mean they have any idea what to do with Dungeons & Dragons. We heard Michelle Rodriguez of The Fast and the Fury, and Justice Smith, who was in Detective Pikachu and one of the Jurassic World movies, I think the most recent.
Yeah.
So they're involved. We don't know their roles, but we do know that there was an announcement that Hugh Grant is now being promoted as the film's antagonist.
Okay.
So along with, and they're not saying that, not saying what role she has, but Sophia Lillis from It. She was the female Beverly in It. So she was a good actress. I think she has got a nice presence. I think she's got a Netflix series as well. But I don't think for Dungeons and Dragons, I don't know how she's going to work. I mean, she looked cute with elf ears. I mean, you can't say that. But Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
So unless he's going to chew the kind of Jeremy Irons scenery that was happening in these previous films, I have no idea why you would...
Money? Like, okay, I suppose like someone had to approach him with this thing, right? Or some kind of agent would have to say, hey, you'd be great in this thing. But I have to think he would just say, how much is it? Okay, yeah, fine.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe we'll needs to, like, I don't know, fund an expansion to like his mansion or something, or like why do established celebrities like that take any kind of role?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of like, I don't know, name recognition and stuff. I mean, he's looking like an elderly man, so I don't know. I guess he'll work as an evil wizard.
Maybe if he's the antagonist, it can't be Elminster or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So if you remember, if we travel back to the wonderful time of the first attempt at a Dungeons and Dragons official Dungeons and Dragons movie, that was Justin Whalen, Marlon Wayans, Thora Birch, Jeremy Irons. It had It made $33.8 million on a $45 million budget.
Wow.
And so didn't do well, but did get two sequels. One was a made-for-television, and I think one was a kind of half-assed cinematic sequel. So Wrath of the Dragon God and the straight-to-video was The Book of Vile Darkness.
Which The Book of Vile Darkness is watchable.
Mm-hmm.
Only because it's so bad.
Oh, right.
Like, so it crosses kind of into the...
Yeah.
This is terrible, which is why it's entertaining. Where the other ones are just like, why am I watching this?
Yeah. So the history so far of the rights, in 2015, they started kind of pre-production, kind of trying to put this deal together at Warner Brothers. But then the project moved over to Paramount in 2017, and then it's been kind of sitting there. And now we have Hasbro and E1, which is their kind of entertainment development team. So they're not only doing this, but they're also planning on a live action TV series with John Wick franchise producer and writer Derek Kolstad.
Yeah, because when I think D&D, I think Gun Fu.
John Wick, right. Yeah. Sorry, so it doesn't sound like we're going to have any luck this, what, fourth time around? Yeah, I don't think.
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to do any better. It sounds like just a mess, and yeah.
I wonder if, again, I don't really know how movies get produced that clearly, but maybe, I know, like, maybe who has it now? Paramount or whatever?
Yeah.
Maybe they're going to lose the IP license. And this is just one of those.
Right. Use it or lose it kind of things.
Yeah. Get it done before Hasbro gets it back for their new entertainment wing or whatever. So,
yeah. And I think I sent you this in text, but this is a really good depiction of how well media and Hollywood understand what to do with Dungeons and Dragons.
This is just one giant verbal raspberry.
Yeah, right. So this is the description of an article talking about the Dungeons and Dragons movie. So the game, Dungeons & Dragons, is known for its war games, treasure hunts, and camaraderie, and reversals of fortune, all in a fantasy setting that combines humans, elves, orcs, and hundreds of other creatures. So that's kind of the level of understanding. That's what probably the screenwriter started with as far as, well, I've got to include hundreds of other creatures, camaraderie, and wargaming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. We all know my feelings on D&D, but like, this movie is going to be a flop either way. But anyway, I mean, it's going to be an even bigger flop if you market it only to gamers.
Right.
Right. Because as big as we think the hobby is, the general public is a lot bigger.
Right.
So you got to pitch it to the general public if you want it to be successful at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's kind of like a discussion I was having possibly with Alan earlier about like Marvel stuff, where like my thing is like, I don't want to have to, or in Star Wars too, like, I don't want to have to consume a bunch of other media to know what the fuck is going on in a movie. Like, a movie's got to be self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with, and I totally understand, putting in Easter eggs to kind of reward the people who have engaged with the other media.
Right.
It's like, oh, look who just walked by, or, oh, you know, they just bumped into this person, whatever. Mm-hmm. If you make it only for those fans,
it's
not going to work.
No, that's true.
So, while that description was laughable in how not about kind of D&D it was, that's probably the level you have to write it at to make it accessible to everyone.
Right. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious because, you know, the Lord of the Rings films did well, and there's not, I mean, I'm not sure it wasn't all tabletop players going to see that. So we'll have to see. And then it also depends on what the tabletop market or the brand identity looks like in China, because that's a huge, I mean, because, you know, the Warcraft movie was huge in China because, they're PC gamers, and that was like a big fantasy franchise. Okay. They pirated the hell out of that game. So
I saw Warcraft. It was, you know.
Are you sliding David Bowie's son's direction? So we'll see. This doesn't sound like they really know what they're doing, but as you suggested, this may just be so they don't lose the rights
possibly.
They can keep producing. And also that, you know, they're trying to do D&D anything right now.
Yeah.
So throw everything out there.
Yeah. Cool.
So that's all we got to talk about. That's it for this week.
I got to go back to work. Yeah. Speaking of fun times. Yeah.
Nice. Oh boy. So is Hugh Grant portraying the antagonist at your workplace as well?
No, there's no antagonist other than crushing boredom.
All right. So where can people find you?
On Twitter, usually, as always. That's HiveMind, HyveMynd, where I forget what I'm talking about currently. It changes so often. But now that we're live, it's not like a week out of date.
Right. Yes. It won't be a week out of date. So the Kickstarter for RPG we talked about is still active.
Oh, yeah. Coyote and Crow. Yeah. Still up. Yes, as opposed to like, ended like we did before. Yeah.
Right. So it's like it just ended, and then we'll post the video. Yes. So thanks for joining us live. If you would like to support this live show, please consider becoming a weakling at patreon.com/idleredhands. And you can also follow us on Twitter at idleredhands, and both Twitch and YouTube is where this video resides. So, that's the best way to get involved. And we'll also, I guess, be doing the audio as a podcast.
Oh,
I haven't figured out the best way to be doing that yet. So we may have a new home for the actual audio of this podcast. But for right now, it's going to be a live thing.
Nice.
All right. So that's it for this week. We'll see you again next week.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.